First case for argument is Nelson Brothers v. Freeborn and Peters. Mr. Teague.
Ty, Your Honor. Thank you. To please the court, Joseph Ty on behalf of Freeborn and Peters.
Ty, can you pronounce your
name? Ty. It's an
Ty.
Irish
okay. I'm sorry.
Affectation. Everything after the I was to impress the neighbors down the hill. This case, Your Honor, presents an unusual fact pattern in the sense that the claims of malpractice and the sources of damages do not line up. We have uncontested testimony from the plaintiffs individually, Patrick Nelson, that Nelson Brothers Professional Real Estate, LLC, funded the $1.7 million that was identified as the damage components of the case. And yet the jury awarded or found that half of the damages sustained were sustained by the individual plaintiffs who chose to fund their investments through business entities.
I'm very interested in these mechanic liens.
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to the mechanic liens, would the record support an inference that if the plaintiffs had been apprised of the liens, they might have, insisted on additional protections? For example, an escrow fund. And that, in turn, would have avoided the sorts of problems that arose later.
Respectfully, Your Honor, it would not have avoided the problems that arose later because the mortgagee, according to the plaintiffs, acted in derogation of its mortgage commitment and committed, arguably, a breach of its mortgage contract. The duty to warn the plaintiffs and to include those additional protections stems from the foreseeability of the occurrence against which they are to be warned. And foreseeability is an objective test measured by the predictability of conduct. And here, the predictability issue turns to, would a mortgagee with multiple layers of protection against its interests and an acknowledgement that it is fully protected against the risk of mechanics lien, would thereafter say, notwithstanding all of the protections in my contract and notwithstanding my commitments to approve up to 35 tick investments, I am going to decide not to do what I agreed to do because I have an unreasonable fear about mechanics liens.
But they had no opportunity to evaluate the risks.
But with respect to the risk that they did not have an opportunity to evaluate, that was not a risk that my client had a duty to.
Well, is it a certainty that the title insurance would protect them against mechanics liens?
It was uncontested, Your Honor. There was no evidence in the record from anybody that the mechanics liens were a threat to the mortgagee. In fact, we went through with Cynthia Bergman, the attorney from Freeborn and Peters, who put together the loan documents and went through in front of the jury the multiple provisions in the mortgage contract where even if post-acquisition the new acquirers had engaged someone to perform services on the land and thereafter failed to pay, the mortgagee had a contract provision that would have allowed the mortgagor to bond over by tendering a new title insurance policy. But the fact is, the insurance that was in place preceded the funding of the mortgage loan. So the mortgagee, with two layers of mechanics lien protection, an owner's policy and a lender's policy, funded the loan and committed to fund up to 35 or permit up to 35 tick investors thereafter because they knew this was going to be an ongoing incorporation of investors. And the law firm had protected against that by getting the commitment of the mortgagee to permit them if they're otherwise qualified investors, so that wouldn't be a hang-up. And the mortgagee said, we are on board with that. The claim to the jury was that thereafter, and the big thereafter was Lehman Brothers, thereafter in the post-Lehman Brothers environment, perhaps the mortgagee decided to withhold its cooperation. Perhaps the mortgagee decided to engage in some form of additional help for itself, for its business interests, but it had contractually committed to accept an otherwise bona fide, qualified TIC investor because it already had protection against the mechanics liens. And there was no question that that was in place. In addition to that, there was the sales contract, which contained an indemnification provision. There was a warranty deed. And, in fact, as Mr. Lorry testified without opposition, some of the mechanics lien claims themselves were bonded over with the request of the title company. But that is an issue between the title insurance company and the prior owner of the land who committed to reimburse the title company for defects in title. As it relates to a law firm putting together a deal and bearing a duty to make disclosures or to warn of risks, the question is whether that risk was foreseeable, not conceivable. And on the record of this case, with the legal protections in place, I would respectfully suggest that it's not.
Why did Nelson Brothers spend all this money on lawyers with regard to the mechanics liens?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know why they would. Perhaps it's true that the mortgage...
But they must have had some anxiety about the...
They're saying they were injured. They're saying they were injured to the extent that they needed to seek independent counsel to advise them on the ramifications of the guarantees. I mean, why wouldn't that be a valid claim of injury?
Well, Your Honor, because the law in Illinois with direct versus indirect injuries comes into play as well. There is an investment decision made to part with about $1.4 million at the inception of the transaction when Nelson Brothers joins Alliance Northwest. And as to that issue, that is an inducement issue, a negligence leading to the investment. Thereafter, the party in interest is not Nelson Brothers. The parties in interest are Alliance Northwest and Randall Holdings.
But they did spend money on lawyers, right?
Yes, they did, Your Honor, but that was in connection with the threats to Alliance Northwest.
But I thought it was connected with the mechanics plans.
It was connected with the mechanics plan, Your Honor, but that injury was an injury in the operation of the venture.
But I don't understand. Why did they consult lawyers about the mechanics liens? You said there were two levels of protection for them.
Yes, sir.
So why did they spend money on lawyers?
Because as a legally unforeseeable event occurred, and that is that the mortgagee evidenced some threats of discomfort, notwithstanding its contractual commitments. Your Honor, I'm sorry.
I don't understand why that. You know, look, they were trying to fend off or resolve problems that arose because of the alleged malpractice. In other words, to resolve the mechanics liens issue, of which the plaintiffs, I would certainly seem, were kept in the dark. I don't see why that's not a direct compensable result of the alleged malpractice when you then have to, you know, go out and seek new attorneys.
Because, Your Honor, the threat to the party that is threatened by the mechanics lien action by the mortgagee is Alliance Northwest. Alliance Northwest had a contractual relationship
threatened. Why are the Nelsons spending this money on lawyers?
Because the Nelsons have a personal interest, they have an indirect interest in making sure Alliance can fight for itself, and they undertook to make payments to assist Alliance. But under the law, for who gets to make the claim, that would be a claim by Alliance Northwest. We lost money, we incurred obligations to one of our sponsors, Nelson Brothers, and we are the ones who are injured as Alliance Northwest because we're operating a venture that is under threat. But Nelson Brothers is an investor in Alliance Northwest at that time. It's as if I were in a closely held corporation, there was a capital call or a need to borrow money because the corporation had an interest. The corporation can make a claim that it was injured. But my interest is the same as my fellow shareholders. It's indirect to the party that's injured. The $1.4 million that was invested, Nelson Brothers, the business claim would be, we made an investment decision on the basis of an incomplete set of facts from our lawyers. One of those incomplete sets of facts, they allege, is the failure to warn about the subsequent action of the mortgagee. As a matter of law, the question there is, is that foreseeable in that it's objectively predictable?
Well, I gather that Judge Leinenweber thought that the interlocking relationships, because of those, it would be inappropriate to draw the distinction that you're making, you know, between the brothers and the company.
I understand that that was his thought process. In Astor Schoeffer, 20-some years previously, he had reached a different conclusion.
What is the difference between the two Nelsons and the Nelson Brothers Company?
The difference is that Nelson Brothers Company is a legal entity. Nelson Brothers are members of it, and they are distinct from it.
But they're the only members, right?
Right.
Yes, Your Honor, but that makes no difference on the Illinois law.
I don't understand. Why it make no difference? It's just an LLC, right?
They are an LLC. They obtain protection against threats of creditors because they are an LLC, and having availed themselves of the choice to proceed in that manner, they are bound by it. It's in the theory of the plaintiffs, my client would have been exposed to possibly $5.1 million in damages. The individual plaintiffs funded Nelson Brothers, which funded Alliance, which lost $1.7 million. There can only be one recovery, and it goes to who is the directly injured party.
But it certainly sounds interlocked, doesn't it?
It may be interlocked, Your Honor. That's not a reason to give relief past the lockings when the lockings are chosen by the people who lock themselves. The Nelsons individually chose to do business through Nelson Brothers Professional Real Estate. Nelson Brothers Professional Real Estate has rights and makes investment decisions. If that decision was tainted by my client's malpractice, that's the $1.4 million on the duty to disclose.
But
once it invests that money into Alliance, though, Alliance holds that $1.4 million, and Alliance is spending its money as Alliance deems appropriate. And if Alliance is injured, Alliance can sue. And if Alliance recovers, Nelson Brothers has greater value because Alliance is stronger. And if Nelson Brothers has greater value because Alliance is stronger, then the Nelsons individually are in a better position. But the law only
because they are the entity.
Because indirectly they benefit, but the law only looks to the directly injured party, because otherwise the courts have to sort through and say, which of you people and how do we allocate it? And there's a pretty clear direction under the law. You go to the party that is directly
harmed. Did Alliance bring a lawsuit of any sort? Or?
No, sir, and that's
Because they weren't involved with Freeborn and Peters, is that the idea?
No, Alliance, Freeborn and Peters drafted the Alliance Northwest operating agreement. Alliance Northwest, in theory, could have filed a lawsuit if Alliance Northwest believed that it was injured as a result. If there was a break between the owners of Alliance, someone could have brought a derivative claim, but nobody did.
I need to ask you a question. So if we agree with your reasoning, then probably the area I want to ask you about is irrelevant, but I wanted to talk about the general verdict form, because you agree it was a general verdict form.
I agree that it was
General, because there were eight alleged claims.
Yes.
There were eight claims, and you basically appealed four of them, correct?
Well,
because you haven't appealed whether Freeborn advised plaintiffs to obtain independent counsel or whether you failed to edit the mezzanine loan to include the bad boy clause. The reason I'm asking about that is if it's a general verdict, we can affirm on any legal theory. So if we find one viable theory.
I understand. The problem with the mezzanine loan is there was never a default under mezzanine. They called the loan at its expiration. All the interest was paid. There never became an issue on bad boy, and that is addressed in our brief. As to the failure to disclose or to draft, that all comes down to that $50,000 threshold, and that is addressed. One is stated in general terms, and then is stated specifically in the 49999, and Mr. Sharp confirmed that the claim is predicated on the 49999 payment and the failure of my client to alert the plaintiff that there was a break in the control where below a certain amount of money two managers could outvote the third. As to that, however, Patrick Nelson testified he was aware of that provision and discussed it with Mr. Hannon.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Axel?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Brad Axel. I represent the Appalachians, Patrick Nelson, Brian Nelson, and Nelson Brothers Professional Real Estate. With regard to the mechanics liens, plaintiff's expert, Bill Sharp, testified, and the jury found it credible, as did the trial court, that the liens were something that the standard of care required the defendant law firm to notify plaintiffs of and to advise them as how to properly address them.
On that subject, I want to sort of get a bottom line here. Am I understanding your theory correctly when I say that if the plaintiffs had been made aware of the liens, they either would have insisted on something like an escrow fund to avoid the sorts, you know, these problems that arose later, or alternatively, they might have walked away?
Those both are absolutely true, or they would have tried to negotiate a payment of liens to satisfy them so that later the TIC investors wouldn't have seen them and said, how can we invest when you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars of liens on subject property, and the mezzanine lender wouldn't have seen them and been unhappy with that as well.
So,
and that's what Mr. Sharp opined.
So in your view, it was absolutely foreseeable without something more than title insurance to address those mechanic liens that closings would be held up or prevented as here. That's bottom line argument.
Correct. That's what Mr. Sharp testified. Defendant's experts testified otherwise. The jury found plaintiff's
experts. But why isn't title insurance adequate?
Because this isn't a plain old vanilla, forgive me, a real estate closing. One, what we've got injected into it is the law firm, the professional responsibility, and two, we have tenants in common, investments, and a lot of, as you've noted, a lot of different moving pieces here and different structures. And in the circumstances, Mr. Sharp opined that title insurance just wasn't enough, and the proof was in the pudding. The fact is plaintiffs attempted to have the title insurance come in when there was litigation stemming from the liens, and it was delayed. Just because you have insurance doesn't mean that the insurer is going to say, oh, okay, I'll pay them all. The way to make it go away, you pay them all, and then the liens might go away. Well, that didn't happen, and it dragged on, and there were delays and other complications, which Mr. Sharp said were foreseeable. Patrick Nelson testified at trial, if I would have known that the liens were there, I would have known that at a minimum that the TIC investors would have been spooked by them.
That who would have been?
The tenant in common investors that they were trying to solicit to invest in the subject development.
Can you address this issue of Alliance Northwest not being a party?
Sure. I think, Judge, it's a red herring. The fact is we've shown an attorney-client relationship between plaintiffs, and notably the plaintiff LLC, and the defendant law firm, a breach of the duty and causation of their damages. Testimony was adduced at trial, and granted, we're not here to reweigh the evidence, nor would I want to, because I think that there's a reasonable basis in the findings of the jury and the trial court in entering its judgment, but there were damages incurred by Nelson Brothers Professional Real Estate LLC and the individual plaintiffs as well. So the fact that Alliance Northwest was involved in this complicated real estate transaction is what it is, but plaintiff's burden isn't to show why there wouldn't have been another claimant for legal malpractice. We met our burden. We showed it, and the jury agreed.
Could you talk about the role the personal guarantees play in the malpractice claims, and why was it necessary for the plaintiffs to seek additional legal advice on the guarantees, for example, and why is that? Why is that a legitimate component of the damages if, in fact, no default was ever declared, and the plaintiffs were not held liable on the guarantee?
Again, I think that's a red herring. Now, the personal guarantees are noteworthy for two reasons. One, it shows that there's an absolute exception under Bevelheimer and Sterling to the indirect injury prohibition on recovery in Illinois. Specifically, Patrick Nelson and Brian Nelson were personal guarantors on these guarantees that, unbeknownst to Patrick and Brian, were far broader than they thought. The narrow, there were carve-outs that weren't really carve-outs. They were in the dark. Their counsel did not do its job and tell them what their true exposure was.
But again, is it just that they then incurred additional attorney's fees?
Exactly. The fact that they weren't sued on them, yeah, that would be an obvious, a judgment was entered, a lawsuit was brought. Sure, that would be a more obvious means of incurring damages. But here, they had to go out, as was discussed previously, and seek independent counsel, something defendant should have told them to do a long time prior, and have them explain the true extent of their risk and their exposure so they could voluntarily enter into the transactions, knowing the risk, not enter into the transactions, avoid the risk.
You know, speaking of a default, why was no witness from the bank called to discuss the subject of a default or the rejection of a second extension?
Plaintiffs felt they could prove their case without witnesses. Witnesses are, trials don't come off perfectly, and evidence isn't always adduced as we would like it to be put in, and the availability of witnesses and distance we had, as you noted, you know, California plaintiffs, Illinois defendants, and that wasn't the extent of the coverage of the United States. We had a Nevada relationship and whatnot. So, but plaintiffs, and certainly, of course, it ended up being that we felt we met our burden by putting in the evidence another way.
You know, with respect to that operating agreement and the provision on matters that involved less than $50,000 and $49,999, would you please address exactly what the evidence indicates Patrick Nelson knew and understood about the agreement, and specifically what you believe Mr. Hannon and the Freeborn firm failed to tell him?
Certainly. Again, the testimony at trial never is, nor was it in this case, perfect. However, there was a reasonable basis from the record to believe that Patrick Nelson did not fully know the extent of the control that their joint venturers were given, contrary to the understanding that Nelson Brothers had with their joint venturers. Now, Patrick testified at one point, and I paraphrase, that he needed a lawyer to understand it. And of course, in the end, plaintiffs felt as though they didn't have counsel, and so counsel, Freeborn and Peters, is drafting, while there's a conflict of interest, operating agreements that did not reflect the understanding of the parties. Specifically, they were unequal. Plaintiffs were given little control with a lot of risk. The joint ventures, Mr. Reinberg and Mr. Fullman, were given a lot of control with low risk. There was a $50,000 threshold above which the operating agreement required additional steps to be taken to spend money, simply put.
But Mr. Nelson was aware of the provision.
In the general sense, he was aware of it.
Okay. He understood it.
Did he? I feel respectfully as though his testimony...
What was he not advised about concerning that?
Right.
Patrick Nelson testified that he was not advised to the full extent of the control that Reinberg and Fullman would have.
Well, be concrete. What do you mean by full extent? They had, what, two-thirds vote for under $50,000?
As I stand here, I don't know specifically. I know that under 50 could go through without plaintiff's approval,
right.
And it was pushed through. And Patrick, when he found out, was surprised and incensed, to say the least. Specifically because
well, I was surprised. How wasn't that? What wasn't that in the contract that they were? You know, these other entities would have the two votes, and you'd have one, and Nelson's would have one vote for under $50,000.
I suspect it was all set forth in the very thick operating agreement, and my clients felt as though their attorneys did not properly advise them.
So are you saying that Freeborn was obligated to walk through the various scenarios that might occur if the Nelsons were outvoted?
I think that they had not.
The Nelsons are experienced, aren't they? They're experienced businessmen.
They were experienced. Obviously, they're not attorneys. This was their first tenant in common type transaction.
But are you saying they were unaware that for these expenditures under $50,000, the other two partners or whatever parties could make determinations without consulting them? Are you saying they're unaware of that?
Patrick Nelson's testimony was that he recalled having discussed it with counsel, but that when it came to be that they were pushing through the payment, he was unaware that they would be able to be
Well, Patrick said he discussed the provision with one of the attorneys and understood it. And Freeborn, via Hannon, told him it would be easier if there were three managers because Reisberg was in Chicago and could do most of the stuff.
Right.
That was his testimony. Right. Didn't he also say that he didn't realize the manager problems until Reisberg decided he would rather pay off Freeborn than the mezzanine lender?
Exactly. And it wasn't just the amount of the payment, but the nature of it. They were paying legal fees at a time where there were other fires, if you will, that should have been put out, or priorities. Or they knew that that was something that, in their experience, the lender was not going to smile.
What was the basis for splitting the damages between the LLC and the Nelsons?
The LLC was responsible for paying for certain damages, and the plaintiffs individually, Brian and Patrick, there was testimony from Patrick, that they spent money.
And that just split 50-50?
It was not 50-50. There was a remittiture whereby, and we agreed to it, whereby the individual plaintiffs were reduced to just under $250,000 from the initial split, which was close to 50-50. It was.
And what did the LLC get?
That remained the same, and that was $786,885.
But before the remittiture, what was it?
It was $721,350.73, split equally as between Patrick Nelson and Brian Nelson, the individuals.
Is that it?
I have nothing further.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Axel, so Mr. Tai.
Yes, Your Honor.
Anything further?
The jury found damages in equal amounts for both sets of plaintiffs, different proportion at fault. They found that one plaintiff was 111 at fault and one was 1/6 at fault. That's why there's 720 versus 786 at the verdict level, and then Judge Leinenweber reduced it because he found that because there was money borrowed from the Nelson brothers' sister, that money was compensable, but the trial evidence was that that money was paid by Nelson Brothers Professional Real Estate. And with all due respect to counsel, Stevenson, Bevelsheimer, that law in Illinois, Sterling Radio, if you read through those cases, the party that pays is the party that claims. In Sterling, Alex Seif was a guarantor. He was exposed to a judgment, but the corporation paid it, and the appellate court said, Mr. Seif, you don't have damages. And I see my red light is on.
Well, but I gather in light of the general verdict, there's no real way to differentiate liability and damages, is there?
Well, the evidence was all to the side that Nelson Brothers Professional Real Estate paid all the money that consisted of damages. And you don't presume damages in legal malpractice in Illinois. The Nelsons individually never parted with a penny that was presented to the jury. They should have been at zero. And if Nelson Brothers, our real estate, was not negligently induced to invest the $1.4 million, Alliance would have been the one to claim for the consequential damages in its operation. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you to both counsel.